Listen to that trumpet. Wait, is that really a trumpet? It sounds kind of weird. Today, on KCUR's Central Standard, trumpeter John Kratzer is here to talk to us about the surprisingly complex history of his instrument and all the crazy sounds it can make, like that one. John, good morning.
Good morning.
What were we just hearing?
Well, that's the tango section from Edward Knight's Sonata Through Salt Rim Glasses. And the reason why it may have sounded a little weird is because there's a mute that you can place in the end of the trumpet, and that one is called the solo tone mute. It was very popular in the 1920s and commercial music, vaudeville music.
So. When you say a mute, I am sure that a lot of our listeners picture like a mute button on a remote control or something. That's not probably what you're putting on a trumpet in the 1920s.
No, it's a cone-shaped device that is made out of any number of materials that you would just place inside the bell, and it changes the timbre of the music. So,
when did your relationship with the trumpet begin?
Oh, probably before I can remember. My father was a trumpet player, and so I grew up hearing it in the house, and my brother Jason played the trumpet, and my brother was, you know, went through middle school with it, and my sister Jennifer also played it. But I was the only one that really stuck with it.
Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. I think I just kind of fell in love with it pretty early on. So, yeah, it's a very diverse instrument, and it allows me to express music and the things that I'm thinking in a variety of different ways.
You know, I mean, it sounds like part of the way that you came to this particular instrument is almost like that it's a family tradition. But I am always pretty fascinated by what draws a musician to a particular instrument. I mean, I think if I played an instrument, it would be the xylophone or vibraphone or something, just because I think mallets are really cool. But for you, I mean, what is it that you love about the trumpet?
I think it's the purity of the sound that you can get when you're playing the instrument, and the variety of ways that you can make it speak. I think just has a wonderful breadth of different sounds that you can make with it.
Can you explain that a little bit more? And you've got some horns in front of you.
Sure.
And if you want to demonstrate, feel free.
Okay, so I guess the standard trumpet that most people would hear is what you call it, a B-flat trumpet. So it's the one that you would imagine any of the jazz musicians playing, or even classical orchestral musicians play this as well. So that's one of the great things about the trumpet, is that you can play jazz with it. You can play 70s rock and roll horn band musics like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, Earth, Wind, and Fire. but you can also play beautiful, you know, melodies that you would hear in classical music as well. So I'll just play a small sample on the B-flat trumpet.
Okay, yeah, thank you. And that's speaking, you know, you were saying that that a trumpet can speak in a lot of different ways. How was the trumpet speaking just then?
I would say that's more of a heroic sound. Maybe you'd hear a fanfare played in that style, or any melodic interlude that you would have in the solo literature.
You've referred to yourself as like a workhorse-style musician, and I think that means not just that you play a variety of contexts, like classical, jazz, funk, but that also you are sort of, I don't know, like willing to step in wherever a trumpet is needed. But why is a trumpet needed so much?
You know, that's a really good question. I wish I could answer that one without giving grandeur to the instrument, but I think
it's
just
okay to give grandeur to it.
I think the trumpet is just, it's so versatile, and it's in everything. It's in music that you hear in the movies. You have wonderful sounds like Tim Morrison, who is one of the finest trumpet players in the world, and you hear him on thousands of movies. It's just such a fantastic sound, but I think it's just so versatile that you can use it in anything. And so when I hear different sounds in my head, I try my best to emulate that. And it really gives me a chance to dig into the depth of the music, which is more than what's on the page.
Well, we're about to get into the history of the trumpet a little more, because that's what Sure. brought you to us. But before we do, I'd like you to play us something. We've talked a lot about the versatility, and you played us something where the trumpet sounded heroic. Mm-hmm. I guess the opposite of heroic is like forlorn and small. And I wonder if the trumpet can sound that way.
I can certainly try. So maybe we'll pick up the flugelhorn for this. And this is a lot mellower sound. Has a nice, warm, buttery sound that you can really express with. Oh, so.
Lovely. You can also hear, I like this, that people can hear you pressing what I would call buttons, but I think maybe they have a technical name.
Yeah, they're called valves.
That makes sense.
So those came about fairly recently as far as the history of the trumpet goes.
Well, yeah, that's what we're about to get into. You're leading a brown bag lunch on the history of the trumpet tomorrow, which is what caught our attention in the first place. So, I mean, how far back does the history of the trumpet go?
Well, the history of the trumpet, we have historical documents that support this. So I'd like to preface this with, I'm just a guy that happens to play some trumpet that's done a little bit of research.
Okay.
But there's evidence of it going back all the way to the Neolithic ages, where people would cut the ends off of conch shells and buzz into them, or hollow out an instrument to make an instrument from an animal's horn.
And how did that transform into the instrument that we have today? I mean, people might think of a trumpet as kind of like a very basic instrument, but as I'm sitting here looking at it, it's got some complex like loop-de-loops and, I mean, shiny metal.
Sure. Well, so the original instruments that were made out of shells and horns had a very limited range and a very limited amount of notes that could be played on it. And that stayed true for a very long time. They were mostly used as signal instruments.
What does that mean? Like to let someone know they're coming or whatever?
Right. Or just to send out signals across the water, across fields that they happened to carry very well in that manner. And eventually, as we learned how to work with metal, people started fashioning horns that were based off of the shells or the horns themselves out of metal. And so it actually became an instrument of war. So you could give signals that what type of attack to give or that someone is indeed coming. So
did it surprise you to find that the instrument that you play musically had been an instrument of war?
No, I don't think it surprises me because I think in most hands, the trumpet probably still is an instrument of war.
What do you mean by that?
It takes a lot of practice to get a good sound on the trumpet. And so most folks, when they're starting out on the trumpet, it might sound a bit like a Hoover with some gravel in it.
So we are at a point in history where the trumpet becomes an instrument of war. How does it evolve, like, physically, the actual object, in order to become something else?
Sure. So as we learn how to build instruments, we started experimenting with different lengths, which allows you to play on different harmonic series. And what harmonic series are the notes that are just spread out on the instrument. And as you become closer on each harmonic series, you get more notes. So the particular trumpet I have in my hand right now, this is probably our first real trumpet ancestor. It's called a natural trumpet, and it has no valves like the other ones.
Yeah, and it's got like ropes.
Yeah, so at one point in time in history in Europe, trumpet making became a protected trade. And so there was an
What is a protected trade?
Right, so there was an imperial trumpet and kettle drum guild. And because it was an instrument of war, if you weren't a part of that guild, you were not allowed to play or even produce the trumpet or the kettle drums in those days. And an interesting tidbit of history is that if they found you with playing trumpet, they would come in and smash up your instruments and maybe break out your teeth or your fingers so that you couldn't play anymore.
That is a high price to pay for playing the trumpet. Do you think you'd do it?
Oh, yeah, I probably would have been in the guild in those days.
So why don't you play a little for us on this first ancestor trumpet?
Sure. All right.
So explain how you are getting different notes. You are doing something different with your hands, but actually it's something that doesn't seem unrelated to how you would play a valve.
Sure. So the holes that are on this particular trumpet are really there for compensating to modern pitch. Back in the days of the Baroque, which is when this instrument would have been primarily played, they had different tuning systems, and so to adjust to the modern ear, these holes are put here to just make it work with our current system of tuning.
The sound of that trumpet, I mean, I would describe it as maybe a little tighter than, a little more constricted than the sound of the other trumpets that you've played so far, which sounds a little more open. Am I making that up?
No, you're right. And, you know, it's just a long piece of tube. And the higher we go, the closer the notes come together. And so that sound is coming out of a much smaller bell. And you usually don't hear people playing this instrument unless they're a specialist. And so what they generally play is the piccolo trumpet, which is has the valves. And that's a modern recreation of the Baroque trumpet.
So what happened that got us from there to here?
Okay. Well, after the Baroque era, we started getting closer into the classical era. They just started to develop keyed trumpets and slide trumpets, which basically moved a piece of leather over the holes, which allowed you to get different notes. And from there, we had the keyed trumpet, which allowed you to play chromatic notes, which are outside of what we would consider the diatonic system.
The diatonic system.
Right. So the diatonic system means that, let's say, for example, someone is in the key of C. That means that they can only play the notes within that key. And so if you wanted to change keys on an older trumpet, you had to put in a different crook, which is that curled part at the top. So there are different crooks that you could plug into it to put into one key. So it's not a very fast change around.
Can you demonstrate something on this trumpet, something that possibly, I mean, what if you played the same thing we heard before and we could hear how it sounds different?
Sure. So this is the piccolo trumpet. It's got a little bit of a more brilliant sound.
It's funny because that instrument looks shinier than the other one, and it also sounds shinier.
Yeah, this is a piccolo trumpet, and they were developed in the mid-20th century. But it's just silver-plated. My other horns are raw brass. It's just a preference.
Could you, before we go, play your favorite sound a trumpet can make? That was awesome. What was that?
That's just the sound of jazz, which, you know, I believe we have a very rich history of here in Kansas City, and it's one of the reasons why I came here.
What do you think the trumpet... Talk to me about the trumpet's role in jazz.
So the trumpet's role in jazz, it's... I think it's always been a bit of a lead instrument. If you listen to the any of the big bands of the swing era, even to the modern swing era, it's always that top voice that you hear. And it's generally carrying the melodies, and it's very exciting. It's a very exciting sound.
So people can go to this brown bag lunch tomorrow at Westport Presbyterian for more on the history of the trumpet. Mm-hmm. What about the future? I mean, are people doing new things with the instrument? Do you see contemporary composers taking it new places?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, new music is why we have to continue to play the instrument. Otherwise, I think as an art, it may not thrive as it should. So composers like Greg Simon, they're writing pieces for electronic media and trumpet. You have the Clarion Duo, which consists of Melody Steed and Dr. Keith Benjamin from the Conservatory, and they've commissioned all new works.
John Kratzer, trumpeter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Up next, remembering the stores that defined a time, a place, or a way of life here in Kansas City, from old school department stores to more recent staples like Bruce Smith Drugs and Tiffany Town. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. At the beginning of the year, customers of Bruce Smith Drugs in Prairie Village found a note on the door of their beloved neighborhood pharmacy, which had closed for temporary restructuring in November, then never reopened. The note ended this way: "We are blessed for the many years we've been able to have you in our lives, and we will miss you all." This might seem like a sentimental farewell, but the connection was emotional for customers, too. In my own childhood, Bruce Smith was a popular place to go in Prairie Village or the Plaza if you happened to have $5 in your pocket. You'd walk over with your friends, browse the cat calendars, the chapstick flavors, you know, the good stuff. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about iconic Kansas City shops that are no more. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us about the place you remember and the time or community it represents. 816-235-2888. Let's hear from our guests. Monroe Dodd is here. He's a journalist and local history guy. Hey, Monroe.
Good morning, Gina.
What is it that becomes history when a retail shop that was once popular in some corner of the city closes?
Well, you know, our memories tend to fog over the bad parts and sometimes enhance the good parts of it.
As with everything.
Yes, especially if we were children visiting a store. A store, to a child, everything seems big. People who are short in adult life are really big to a kid, and stores can be really big. There's possibly the best known and most mentioned store that I can think of in Kansas City is the old Emery Bird Thayer store, which occupied most of the block between along 11th Street between Grand and Walnut. And people, you can read obit after obit in the Star, which I did yesterday, skimming electronically. And so-and-so was proud to mention she was a milliner at Emery Bird Thayer, or a fashion designer at Emery Bird Thayer, or heck, operated the elevator at Emery Bird Thayer. That's a point in life that they remember because people remember it. And they remember it because that was a destination, an aspirational kind of place, I think, for a lot of people. Not for everybody, but for a lot of people. And it lay along a place in Kansas City called Petticoat Lane, in an area that was once the go-to area in Kansas City for shopping for fine stuff. Not for the cheapest stuff, but maybe for the best or the better sorts of things. Not only in women's clothing, but in men's clothing and in food and cloaks and all kinds of things.
What are some recent closures that made you personally realize that some aspect of daily life in Kansas City had gone the way of the dodo?
I think you made a great comparison in Bruce Smith Drugs. It was my go-to place for cheap reading glasses. They always had a better selection than anybody else. And maybe that's the bane of stores these days, of carrying too much inventory. But when you can say, I think I'll drive a few blocks and go and get this rather than order it on the internet, and people are friendly there, and people seem to be kind of interested in you, but not too interested in you, and they aren't programmed to be interested in you, as too many chain stores do, that makes them good.
Well, we've got someone in our studio who can tell us about this from his own perspective. KCUR's Sam Zeff, whose family was connected to one of those Kansas City department stores back in the day. It was called Zeph's. Hi, Sam.
Morning, Gina.
Tell me about Zeph's.
Well, there's actually two Zeph's department stores, actually. There's the original one, which was on Southwest Boulevard in Rosedale, Kansas City, Kansas now. That was the original one. That was my grandfather who came over from Eastern Europe, my namesake, Sam. That was started early in the 1900s. It started off as a shoe store and a shoe repair shop. Eventually, it was taken over by my Uncle Isidore, and it operated until about 1975 as a dry goods store. My favorite story about the original Zeph's, by the way, is during the Depression, the government would give people coupons for various goods. And the only place in Kansas City, Kansas, where you could redeem a coupon for shoes was at the Zeph's department store. So while my father would claim poverty during the Depression, they really weren't that bad off. My father then started another Zeph's store. This was a discount house on 9th and Central, right across the street from the Savoy Grill. This is where I grew up in, worked in as a child. Eventually, he sold it to my uncles. And it operated into the 90s, along with two other branch stores, one in Overland Park, one in Kansas City North. So the Zeph's have always been, at least the original, the previous generation, had always been in retail.
You know, what do you think that this store represents in terms of your own identity or your family's identity?
Well, in my own identity, as a child and as a young man, I was always identified with Hoosier, is Carl, Alvin, Ruby, all my uncles. Which one is your dad? And then how is that connected to either Southwest Boulevard or 9th Street? As I've gotten older and my uncles and my father have passed, that doesn't happen, although Monroe asked me about it. And a funny story, I was in the Capitol about 2 months ago and doing an interview with a state representative from Kansas City, Kansas, and I didn't know him very well. And I handed him my card, and he looked down, he goes, Zeph's. He goes, are you related to the Zeph's on Southwest Boulevard? Because that's where I used to go every year to get my school clothes. And I said, that's exactly where I used to go for my school clothing. So there are still people who remember it, but as we get a little bit farther away from the closing of the stores, it's thinning out just a little bit.
You know, I mean, do you think that being in retail is kind of a way of life in and of itself that, or like a role in a community or neighborhood that, I don't know, someone kind of has to give up when a store closes?
Yeah, you know, I think that there is a, I think you're either born into retail or you're not. I mean, I certainly
I've heard that about farmers, but never about retail.
And I certainly didn't have the retail gene in me and had no desire to do retail after I got out of high school and started in a career in journalism. But I think you do become part of the community. I think it's probably less so now, right? So the people that identify, that Monroe was talking about Emery Bird Thayer, and everybody, sort of a certain generation, certainly knows them. To relate to that as either an employee or someplace where you used to go to have your to buy your school clothing or to get your wedding dress or, you know, a Valentine's Day present, you know, that's I don't mean to knock Macy's, but it doesn't have that that appeal to it. Certainly my relatives were part of the neighborhood that they were where the store was. The original Zeph's on Southwest Boulevard, you know, you'd my Uncle Isidore would go down the street to eat at the Dagwoods, and he was just part of the landscape. That was also true downtown as well. My uncles would go, as well as I, to the old Sammy's Luncheonette, which was this really rugged hamburger place just down the street on 9th Street. So you do become part of the landscape, and I think part of the neighborhood in a really good way.
When you talk about a luncheonette, too, that's like part of that neighborhood, I mean, I think of some of these shops can be part of how we remember the aesthetic of an era almost. And so recently, another closure was Tiffany Town. Tiffany Town reminds me of the aesthetic of childhood in the 80s. And that was when I was a child, and all of my friends, if there was somebody's birthday party coming up, you would go to Tiffany Town. I sound so old right now. You would go to Tiffany Town and you would, for them, select some plastic trinket, like a pencil holder. And then you would tell the person behind the counter the name of your friend who had a birthday coming up. And this person would use a very specific kind of lettering with paint pen to write that person's name. And this was a really treasured, this was like a very popular birthday present. And it was really cool to have these things with your names in paint pen, and it had these dots where the edges of the letters would meet and form corners. And I went there before they closed, I mean, maybe like a couple of years ago, because I thought, oh, my niece is old enough that she should really have one of these paint pen things. And I didn't even get the sentence halfway out of my mouth when the person behind the counter said, she's retired. And it was the person who did the lettering. But I guess people my age were coming in a lot for kids and nieces and nephews and people wanting to do that. But that era was already over. And in a way, that means that the Tiffany Town era was over. To me, it means that.
Well, and I think that it wasn't just Tiffany Town. It wasn't just Bruce Smith. And I loved the Bruce Smith drugs when I lived in Prairie Village. But the Tune Shop over there was, I don't know how many kids went through there to rent their instrument over the 40 years, 50 years that they were in business.
Well, let's get talking to our callers. Anne in North Kansas City has a place she remembers. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I'm kind of going, I really feel old. I was raised in Independence, and there was this place approximately Nolan Road and I-70 that existed. It was a family outing to go to this place, and it was called Wild Woody's.
Tell us about Wild Woody's. It sounds wild.
Oh, Wild Woody's was this huge ramshackle. It was just a huge junk store.
What and kind of junk?
Anything and everything you could imagine. And everything was like a huge garage sale. It was a building, and they had some kind of huge sign, and I don't remember what was on it. I think it was like a cowboy figure, but you could get anything in there, and it was always a bargain. And if we were bored, I was a very young child in the 70s. If we were bored, it was like, let's go to Wild Woody's, because my father and my older brothers could always find some bargain there.
What?
But at the same time, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was just wondering what you think is gone now that Woody's is gone. Or, like, what did this place represent about that time and about the way you grew up, maybe?
A place that a whole family could go to. I mean, it was a family outing to go to Wild Woody's. And now, I mean, I don't think families necessarily shop together like that. I think it's more, you know, the females will go buy clothes and they'll go out shopping together, and men traditionally don't care for shopping, and it's more segregated, where this was something that we all went to, and it was just, it was fun. And we'd always come home with something, usually ridiculous, but only spent a couple dollars on, but it was like a whole afternoon. And I remember they had a popcorn machine. And you always got free popcorn.
Nice.
Which was a big deal to a little kid, you know. And it was just this family outing. And
yeah.
I don't know of any place right now that exists like that.
An outing that's, not specifically for the kids or for the parents. Just a place where everyone has fun. Monroe, I mean, talk to us about the changing ways people shop. Like, that's kind of what she's getting at.
As the metropolitan area exploded miles and miles in every direction because land is so cheap around here and suburbs went up and things. All these stores that used to be destination places downtown, from the smallest to the largest, went out with either branches to those areas or died off and some chain took over. I don't know if it's an outing anymore to go five blocks to the Home Depot or to the Lowe's. An outing to go to Walmart, you don't think that anymore because there's another Walmart a mile or so away. The individual places have begun to fade away as corporatization takes over those things. And it's certainly no outing to sit down at your computer or take your iPhone and order something from Amazon. And that's a lot of what retail is these days.
Let's hear from Kent in Mission. Hi, Kent.
Hi. Well, this is a side note for the last caller, she might want to check out Red X. It sounds a lot like Wild Woody's. Anyway, that's not why I called. When I grew up, there was in Fairway a place called Mission Highlands. It was a little general store on 60th and Mission Road. There's now an animal hospital there. But anybody that grew up in the 70s, 80s, or 90s would, if you just said the little store, they'd know exactly what you were talking about. And it was just a little, you know, they had a fabulous butcher shop. The gentleman that owned it was a really nice old guy that I swear he never went home or slept. I mean, he was there before the crack of dawn and setting the place up. And then at night you could see him, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he'd be in there counting money. And he, you know, hired family and the people that he hired, even that were not family, his daughter, Geraldine, was a really sweet gal. She worked there forever, probably. But he treated everybody like family, customers like family. You know, I could go in there and cash any denomination of checks.
That's trust.
Cash any questions. Yeah. And, you know, he had a big, nice place reportedly down on Lake of the Ozarks that he never went to. He just bought this big place for his employees to go recreate in.
Oh, man. You know, Kent, I want to hear from Sam Zeff on this, because the idea of, like, the retail person as a kind of person who forges a kind of relationship.
You know, my father was in Stanley, Kansas, long before it was a suburb, and we bought an old barn down there. It was eventually Joe's Barn, the restaurant. When we bought it, though, turned it into a place we called Carl's Corral. It was a grocery store, dry goods store, what have you. And we would cash any check that would come through. We would extend credit to almost anybody in the neighborhood. But as I was listening to this, I was reminded of a place I go most Saturdays to get donuts for State House Blend, which is John's Space Age Donuts in downtown Overland Park. A few months ago, I was going through there, and they only take cash. And I thought I had enough, but I didn't. And it was such a throwback, because the guy behind the counter, one of two men who owned it, who took it over from their father, looked at me and said, "Just take care of me next week."
Because you're a regular.
Right. But, you know, I'm a regular at the Price Chopper, and they don't do that there. It was just reminding me of the kind of relationship that you forge with your regular customers, right? You trust that the check is going to be good. They absolutely knew that I was going to come back with $6 or $7 for the donuts the next week. And you tend to start to miss that, no matter how pleasant the greeter is at the Target, and they're all very nice people there. It's not the same as shopping at a family store.
You know, I often say that you have to imagine, long ago events in Kansas City, you have to wipe away the freeways so you can see what the city was like. Well, in the case of retail, you have to wipe away the internet and think, gosh, there were people that would do that, and you would hear about it from somebody. Before there was social media, some friend or associate at work would say, "You want hardware? The best selection is probably down at Strasser. Try Strasser." And whether it was true or not, you would go to Strasser. And there were often guys there, at least in the 70s and the 80s, who knew everything about locksmithing and plumbing and all kinds of things. That's the kind of story you kept going back to. Reputation had a lot to do with it.
Let's hear from Diane in Independence. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What can you share?
I'm going back to that comment about Emory Bird Thayer building. What I recall about that building as a child was the pneumatic tube system that they had for, taking your charge card up to the office. See, when you bought something and they had like little, they'd take an impression off of your charge card with little metal plates, and then they'd send that through the pneumatic tubes up to the office so that your charge would be approved, and then they'd send it back, and it would have a whoosh sound and a ding sound, and this would be going on all over the building. It was fascinating.
You know, that reminds me also of going with parents to the bank, you know, the drive-through at the bank, and you would see that same pneumatic tube system there.
Yeah, it's the same principle, but these tubes were smaller. Yeah, they were developed in the 1890s.
And I mean,
they had a pneumatic tube system that went through New York City.
Yeah, that used to be the precursor to the subway. It was.
Well,
you got to trust me
people,
on this.
But it took. It didn't take people, but it took objects. You know.
Well,
money.
I love that Diane was fascinated by being able to see what would be kind of like a mundane thing by most standards, like your parents having to figure out, you know, like however your parents are paying for something when you're a kid. That's pretty mundane. But when it has all of this sensory stuff going on and you can kind of see, I don't know, you can kind of see how all this stuff is working, that's a lot more interesting for a kid than, you know, like kind of something that you can't really see happening. And that's the deal with doing all this stuff on our phones and stuff like that. You can't see what's happening. It all looks the same.
The internet and the, today's world, plastics, technology, all have brought these monstrous creations in movies and in amusement parks and other stuff that just wow kids. And 50 years ago, those weren't nearly as big and took a lot less to wow you.
So before we go, I mean, I want to know from both of you what places meant something to you and why. Places that aren't around anymore.
Just picking one, Jenny's Italian Restaurant down in the North End. Now, that's not a retailer. It's a restaurant place. But I knew it had a history. In fact, I never was in the original old yellow brick place. But I remember it, and I love the food there.
Mine is not a store either. It's actually an arcade that was downtown called Wonderland. I used to, when I was a kid, my mom would take us down to the plaza where we would catch the bus to go downtown and go to the Wonderland. And it was really a pinball arcade. It had sort of the early versions of video games. But my favorite was there was a shooting game there that it was an actual gun. It was a .22 caliber rifle. You'd put a quarter in, you'd get like 3 .22 shells, and you would fire into what was sort of a big barrel into a target.
This sounds very dangerous.
Well, you know, I think today you couldn't get insured for that kind of
right, that kind,
that kind
of
operation. But just the notion that as a kid, in grade school, that your mom felt comfortable enough to put you on a bus to go to downtown Kansas City so that you could spend $5 or $10, probably closer to $5, at the arcade downtown. The Wonderland was really a terrific place, I thought.
So it sounds like it reminds you of a different kind of freedom for kids.
It reminded me of, that you used to have to leave the house to play video games. And I liked that. And there was always a lot of people down there. It smelled kind of greasy. There probably was a little danger to it. And to this day, I like a little danger with my entertainment. I really love the Wonderland.
Monroe, before we go, we're going to be talking shortly about a regular caller on this show, especially our history shows. His name was Joe Lewis Maddox, and he died just a couple days ago. What can you tell me about Joe as a caller? What stands out to you?
His attention to detail, his memory for detail, and his ability to see the past, especially the African-American past in Kansas City, in all its aspects. I remember once he called to talk to us about Watermelon Hill, a place in Swope Park, which is about the only picnic shelter number 5, where black people were allowed to picnic and to recreate and stuff. And it's a symbol, in a way, of our shameful, segregated past when blacks were denied so many other things. He knew that, and he talked about that. But he also talked about, once they were there, the people in the segregated society, what great times they had, what wonderful clothes people had, the smell of barbecue on the pits, the games they played, all the fun and the wonderful side they had at Watermelon Hill. And so he encompassed the panorama of stuff. And I thought that's great in a historian.
What about the way he researched gave him that kind of intimacy of knowledge, I guess is how I would put it?
Well, he was obviously assiduous at his research. He talked to people. He didn't just read. He didn't just talk to people. He did it all.
Monroe Dodds, Sam Zeff, thank you both so much.
Our pleasure.
My pleasure.
More about Joe Lewis Maddox when KCUR Central Standard returns. A local historian by the name of Joe Lewis Maddox has died, and we're remembering him on KCUR's Central Standard because his approach to history was so entwined with real people and their communities that we know some of our listeners are probably saddened, not just intellectually, but really personally by this news. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Sharon Sanders Brooks, good morning.
Good morning.
Sharon is a historian and former Kansas City City Council person, also representative. She's on the board for the Black Archives of Mid-America. Hi, Sharon, how do you remember Joe?
Fondly, very fondly. It was an honor to have known Mr. Maddox for all the years that I did know him. Whenever you saw him, he always had a wonderful new bit of history to share with you, or if not history, then a life lesson.
Where was he digging up new history all the time? I had that experience of him as well. If I would be out in public doing an event, he would often come up, eagerly afterwards to tell me about his new discovery.
Well, not his new discovery, but the last project that he was working on was to make sure that the story of African Americans and their contribution to World War I was fully recognized and included in the upcoming April 6th centennial here in Kansas City and globally.
Yeah, he was, I guess not just always digging up things, but passionate about them because it was personal to him. He was an advocate for the recognition of African American history.
Yes.
Eric Heitman of BNIM Architects is also here. He's on the Historic Preservation Commission, and Joe was also a member. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
How do you remember Joe?
Well, Joe, Mr. Maddox was the heart and soul of the Preservation Commission. I started my service on the commission in 2009, I believe, and I was very fortunate to sit next to Joe, and he kind of showed me the ropes and led me through. But Joe had served on the commission starting in 1976, and had served for five mayors. So there's really, I doubt anyone in Kansas City who had a finger on the pulse of Kansas City's preservation movement like Mr. Maddox did. I'll always remember him as the person on the commission who was the friendly face. I mean, there's often times that we have very tough hearings, that we talk about very personal things with applicants, owners of their about their homes. Sometimes there's very hard decisions that the commission has to make, and they're not always, very enjoyable things for people to be a part of. But Joe, he was such a just amazing person and an ambassador for the city. I will always remember he had made a point of recognizing properties that were over 100 years old.
Recognizing how?
Well, at the end of a case that we would hear, if the property had been built more than 100 years ago, he would make a point of recognizing that and then thanking the applicant, the property owner, for their stewardship of the property. Even if it had been a contentious case, he found a way to bring it back to a very positive outcome. And he was, I think, in the paper, someone had referred to him as a gentleman. He was such a gentleman. He was such a mentor for me as a commissioner. And, I live in the Plaza Westport neighborhood. Steptoe was something that he and I bonded over. We talked quite a bit about.
A historic neighborhood where a lot of Black people who had just gotten freedom settled.
That's right. It was a very unique community in Kansas City where freed slaves, this was even before the Civil War, were able to purchase property in Kansas City and remained an African-American community up until, I mean, even today, the St. James Baptist Church in our neighborhood is, you know, a fixture. And so he was very strong advocate for presenting that history.
Sharon, what were some of his other passions?
Primarily, I know Mr. Maddox from so many different organizations, but justice and fairness. But the love of African-American history, the love of the role of African-Americans, especially in the military. He was a military veteran. He served in the Vietnam War. But he wanted to make sure the early history, the Civil War, World War I, that those were recognized. But I would like to share some buildings that have particular significance. Last night at the Historic Kansas City Foundation, two buildings that he was definitely involved with were recognized for their historic renovation. One was the Paseo YMCA, where the Negro Leagues Baseball League was founded, and the Black Archives of Mid-America, our new location at the former at Parade Park. And due to Mr. Maddox's effort, as well as the others on the commission, both of those buildings are now on the National Register of Historic Places, as well as Lincoln High School and the Mutual Musicians Foundation, which was the first building to be placed on the National Register of Historic Buildings here in Kansas City.
We've described Joe, we've heard him described as a gentleman, and I like that a lot. I also, though, there's something about that word that implies a formality. And Joe was not very, he was very informal in so many ways, in a really special kind of way. And I wonder if anyone can talk about that aspect of him, just his approach to dealing with other human beings and with history.
He was indeed a gentleman at all times, and he made you feel special. When he was talking to you, I remember the twinkle in his eye, but he would always make you feel special. And to me, one of the things he said was to make sure you have your niche. Though I'm a historian who specializes in African American history, my niche is the contributions of African American women. So when he would present the Civil War or World War I, then I would present the role of African American women in those war efforts. And it was due to him saying, narrow your focus and have a niche.
What do you know about his own past? You've mentioned that he was a veteran. What else do you know about him and maybe what drove him?
Mr. Maddox was born in Caruthersville, Missouri. One of the things, one encounter he shared with me, he had the opportunity to meet President Harry S. Truman in Caruthersville. And at that particular occasion, he had the opportunity to speak to President Truman, and he said he wanted to go to college. And due to segregation in Missouri at that time, instead of the University of Missouri, Columbia, President Truman said Lincoln University, and he took that to heart. He did attend and graduated from Lincoln University.
Well, thank you so much. I know it's hard to say goodbye to a friend, and I appreciate you doing it so publicly. Sharon Sanders Brooks, historian, former Kansas City City Council person on the board of the Black Archives of Mid-America, thank you so much. And Eric Heitman of BNIM Architects on the Historic Preservation Commission with Joe Maddox. Thank you.
Thank you.
And yes, we will, at KCUR, we'll also remember Joe Lewis Maddox and we'll listen back to the shows with him fondly. Tomorrow, our food critics will be here to talk about brunch, the special weekend and vacation meal that's like a party every time. Call in with your favorite brunch spots in town tomorrow at 10. We'll also hear the story of a good jam from seed to fruit to tasty topping on a roll. That's tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.